Blues for M.F. Jakubowski. You know it's time, Jakubowski, when sneezing from chalk dust and paper cuts are the most noteworthy parts of your day, and the girls in your eighth grade class say you look just like your their grandfather, and your grandfather says it's a shame you never had a real job. When your wife starts to call it a 10-week vacation, and you thought you were laid off for 2.5 months, and the president of the union lectures the teachers on school board time. It's time when rookie teachers come to you for advice and actually listen when you say something, and you start to teach the kids of the kids you taught your first year, and the kid you coached at third base in Little League teaches science in the room beside yours. It's time when the Xerox machine breaks down and the principal pages you over the squawk box to fix it. When the school board psychologist tells you he can't help you with your last period class because you can't rehabilitate what ain't been bilitated. And the kids won't fight in your classroom because they're afraid you'll get hurt breaking it up. When you tell the superintendent what MF stands for, and 500 black kids can't be wrong, and the Vietnam vet quit 40 years ago to re-enlist after teaching 3 periods in your middle school. It's time when the junkyard dog in the school library doesn't make you sign out the swimsuit issue of Sports Illustrated. And the teachers who used to play basketball and drink after school every Friday don't even drink when you offer to buy now. You know it's time, Jakubowski, when the kids keep getting younger and faster and blonder, and you keep getting older and slower and grayer. Thank you. Jimmy, June, thank you, and Judy, and Jay, it's good to be here with you guys tonight. When you go into the men's room to clean your glasses and you get them all wet and then you find there's no hand towels in there, you know, life is tough. I just had surgery about 22 days ago and my surgeon drew a little smiley face on my thigh and just went right to work. She did a beautiful job, so it is good to be here. Reading White Knight. White Knight is a book by Anna Akhmatova, the Russian poet. If you don't know her, I'm going to pull rank on you and say you should, and I'm not going to tell you anything more about her, except that she was, in very, very serious ways, the conscience of her people, and also just a totally erotic young woman during the Roaring Twenties in Moscow. The White Knights refer to the knights in the Northern Hemisphere where there's actually, I asked my friend Boris, who is from Petersburg in Russia, I said, how light is it during White Knight time? And he said that you can read a newspaper all night long in outside. So this is called Reading White Knight. The epigraph is from Anna Akhmatova. I got drunk on your voice in the doorway. This morning, reading Akhmatova on the porch, I heard the rumble of the train near the river. The locomotive's throb came clearly from the valley, then rain began falling on hard earth. I put down the book for a minute, looked off toward the sound beyond the evergreens, but could not separate it. Not the rain, not the freight, nor that woman's breath. Clark's Lotus grabbing air. Jimmy Clark was a Formula One driver who I know Formula One is a little bit foreign to some people in the room. Just the coolest racing in the world. They race internationally. They raced at Silverstone, England this past weekend. They've been in Singapore and Malaysia. They go to, I believe it's Abu Dhabi, and this racing has been going on for, I guess, over 50 or 60 years with a little break during World War II, but Clark was a very, very famous Formula One driver. And also I reference Juan Manuel Fangio from Argentina, who was a world champion, as was Jimmy Clark. During the 1956 Grand Prix held in Havana, Cuba, Castro took him prisoner and held him during the race. He actually watched the Formula One on TV in Havana, Cuba then. So a little bit of background information to this poem, which has nothing to do with the poem, but. Clark's Lotus, grabbing air. How little you know of us, writing only precious truth and not fact. Sometimes the road does stretch out forever like dust rising behind a pickup. Or Havana, 1957. The sky, the sea melts, flowing, and Fangio's 3-liter Maserati drifts the S's onto the Malecon. Later, Jimmy Clark's Lotus grabbing air over the jump at Nürburgring. Poem whore, only interested in our death. This is the double clutch downshift into the keyhole. The chassis settles. Coltrane's fingered keys on Naima. I clip the apex, drift out to the line. Poet, you grow smaller in my mirrors. Thank you. Okay, little quiz. Latin. Apologia pro vita sua. Anybody? Apology for my life. Apology in the sense of why I've chosen this religion. John Henry Newman became a Roman Catholic after he was an Episcopal, I believe, bishop or priest. Somebody help me here, but apologia pro vita sua. Again, this has nothing to do with the poem. Geez, guys, I'd love to go out with you and have a brewski or two. But Carol wants me home by 11. Let's try another one. This title does have something to do with a poem. Coyote Ugly. O'Keefe and I had been drinking all night at Miller's. When he went home, she was the only one left in the bar. So we went to her place. In the morning, I woke up. Saw her. She was sleeping on my arm. I chewed it off and left. A couple of new poems, and then I'm going to do a little memoir. It's about baseball, the 1960 World Series, but I think I take a kind of new slant on it. I saw an assignment one time where these college kids had a class where they had to write an epigraph for their tombstone, and I thought, I could never do that, you know. And a couple of months ago, I just sat down, and I wasn't purposely trying to do crazy shit like that, but actually I did it, so here goes. It's called Think of These Shoes. Think of these shoes in the closet, all spit and polish, standing last to last. Little leather soldiers, they go to Goodwill. The shirts and suits will fit St. Vincent de Paul perfectly. The money, a modest amount considering my mountain of immodest thought, divide it fairly, not evenly, if you can. You've done and dreaded this before. The Art Kane jazz portrait, Harlem, 1958, goes to Michael or Don Smith. Ecclesiasticus said, give not up thy heart to sadness, but drive it from thee, for there is no returning, and thou shalt do them no good. Just say, he's off on another one of his adventures and won't need this stuff. Anyway. Thank you. I was driving somewhere today and I saw a little sign. It said, stink bugs? There was a question mark, I think. And then it said www.stinkbug.com or something like that. All right. This poem is called Friendly Fire. I wish you could have seen the little stink bug on a toilet paper roll in the bathroom. To squash him, I thought, would make more smell, right? So I plopped the Sunday paper down, but when I was done, he was on his back, on the floor, feet up, the dead cockroach position. I'd recognize it anywhere. Before I left, I lit a single candle. Ten Buddhist monks in an Indiana, it's Indiana, Pennsylvania, Indiana cornfield. Years after the monks returned to India, their saffron robes danced in the halls of Drepung Monastery like the wind danced with the corn that day. Mailing a package at the post office in Clarksburg, PA. Coal company's houses line Route 286. Rooms added on over the years, everything in need of paint. But in the October afternoon, a goat brays across the highway behind the shed. On the porch steps, a fat lady shaves her legs. Old-fashioned house dress hiked up over her thighs, waiting for her honey. Two. Three ponies gamble in sunlight near Blackleg Creek at the base of the hill. That was named after braves who hunted there. Where are they now, that tribe of urban skins? In Pittsburgh, uncorking a beer, watching the NFL, checking Native American on government forms. Three. The postmistress forgets your receipt, mails it to the return address. A couple of days later, the postman shows up. There's a smiley face on the back of the envelope. Come back again. Yeah, why the hell not? Memoir. 10-13-60. Where were you when it happened? Lou Brickner and I were climbing Sterling Street after school dismissal. Sterling runs up the high side of a ravine from Southside to Arlington Avenue, then over the next hill. The porches of the little houses along the street seem to anchor them so they won't tumble into the ravine, then roll down under Mission Street Bridge that Lou and I had just crossed. Suddenly, a man came out on one of the wooden porches and shouted, "We won! We beat the Yankees!" A half an hour before, Lou and I and the rest of homeroom 202 had been kneeling beside our desks in eighth period physics class, praying that the Pirates would win the final game of the World Series. When we came into class, Sister Elred had the radio tuned to the game and told the class to kneel and pray for the Pirates. There were no objections. We prayed a lot in Catholic school in 1960. We prayed like Jews at Passover. We prayed like Muslims. We prayed before each class. We prayed at spiritual retreats. We prayed when taking the Metropolitan Achievement Test. We did a little prayer before we broke basketball huddles. We prayed at the foul line that the basketball would go in. We prayed that the other teams wouldn't. I signed a cross before going down on one knee, like a genuflection, to shoot my foul shot in front of cheerleaders, coaches, and kids on both teams. My crew cut probably glistened with sweat and energy like a halo. We wore medals dedicated to the Virgin. We wore scapulas like dog tags for the Pope Army. The first time our class laid eyes on one another in the ninth grade, we were praying at Mass in St. Michael's Church. And who can say what power spiritual meditation has? How a baseball might take an odd turn, like an errant sinner, bounce into the Yankee shortstop throat instead of his mitt? And what glint of sunlight in the batter's retina might frame freeze a pitch an instant earlier, making it like Isaiah's cup of trembling, or no, sweet like a cantaloupe in July, so that the batter can pound it over the left field wall? Lou and I continued up to the Fort, our blue-collar country club basketball court playground, where parents back then let us alone to grow up and be sports stars, at least in our own imagination. Then we split up. Lou headed over the hill for Spring Street, and I headed left down a street called Salisbury, then to Josephine Street, around the bend, and up the hill to the Arlington Projects. When I walked into the living room, my mom was still sitting there in front of the big wooden radio with the dial glowing like radium. She was ecstatic, but in her own quiet way. I was doubly happy to see the Pirates and see my mom happy like this. Neither of us suspected that in a month she would suffer a fatal stroke. Every spring, the Pirate ball game came on our radio like the leaves filled the trees, like the rosary came on in the evenings at our house between 7 and 7:15 on KDKA AM. My mom loved all sports, but especially basketball, which she played in high school, and baseball. Roberto Arriba Clemente was my mom's favorite ball player before it was politically correct to love the play of Roberto Clemente. We kidded one another because I loved Mazeroski's toughness and guts. We argued playfully about who was best. And this night was the night when the Pittsburgh celebrated wildly. The last championship was in 1925. And even in our little living room on this brilliant autumn afternoon, the energy was beginning to rise like it was all over the city. It was VJ Day. It was Mardi Gras. People began to pack the Golden Triangle until there were more than 300,000 fans crowding the streets and alleys. That evening, the Liberty Tubes and Fort Pitt tunnels were closed by police to limit the throngs of people coming into the city. Confetti and paper rained down from office buildings, and the Pittsburgh Press reported a Buick convertible filled with girls, its back end dragging and sparking, drove around town with the girls kissing everyone they passed. Pittsburghers won a lot of money betting on the underdog Bucks, and one man from New Kensington reported winning a set of false teeth worth $250. By the next morning, Friday, 110 tons of paper had been cleaned up by 50 city trucks and crews, and Mayor Barr forbade horn honking and riding on the hoods and trunks of cars as the city continued to celebrate. I was glad my mom saw that day. Much of what I remember about her had to do with her illness and heart condition, a result of the world influenza epidemic of 1918-1919. She loved sports, and this brought her joy as it did to all of the Steel City. I never had to ask her, "Did you pray for the Bucks?" It was understood. Everyone who could claim a God in Pittsburgh that afternoon did. Thank you very much.